Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Potok, your host for today. The topic today is one I find absolutely fascinating, and it's one that's become an area of growing scientific interest and research. It's the whole area of mind-body medicine. And today's program will be the first of two Local Talk programs dealing with this subject. For the second program in the near future, we'll be hearing from Dr. Herbert Benson, a physician who's one of the founders of the Benson Henry Institute of Mind-Body Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Benson is also a professor of mind-body medicine at Harvard Medical School, and in addition to numerous scientific studies, he's the author of several popular books on mind-body medicine. I won't be talking to Dr. Benson in today's show, but I'll be keeping his scientific work in mind as part of the wider context and background as I talk with today's guests. And I'm pretty sure that Dr. Benson would see eye to eye with all my guests today, although they tend to express themselves somewhat differently than he does. For starters, they use the term spiritual healing rather than mind-body medicine. My first two guests are members of an international organization called the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends, who are all followers of Bruno Gröning, a German spiritual healer who lived in the early part of the 20th century. And the reason I've chosen to focus on this topic right now is that starting tomorrow, representatives of the Circle of Friends will be holding a series of public lectures in Ames and Des Moines. These lectures are by doctors and healing practitioners visiting from Germany, who will be lecturing on Bruno Gröning's teachings. The first lecture is tomorrow, May 17th, in Ames Public Library at 6 p.m. The second one will be at the Ames Friends Meeting House on Friday, May the 20th, at 7 p.m. But right now, let's hear from Sonia Anderson, who's a member of the Circle of Friends who lives in Minnesota. I spoke to her by telephone.
The Circle of Friends exists to share the teaching of Bruno Gröning with all people, regardless of religion. There is no creed or doctrine, and the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends is comprised of all volunteers. We are drawn together by our common experience of having had some type of healing or help in our life through the teaching, and we all volunteer our time and energy to share this with all people.
Would you like to describe your personal experience with help or healing from these?
I would love to. I learned about Bruno Gröning about 4 years ago. I had been in a very serious car accident, and I had a pain in my mid-back. I had been receiving a lot of different healing therapies to try to relieve the pain. Chiropractic, acupuncture, massage, Yeah, those were the main ones. And a friend of mine asked me if I would be open to spiritual healing, and she told me about the Circle of Friends. So I went to a meeting, and I was able to feel in my body this healing stream. Bruno Gröning was German, and he called this the Heilstrom,
right.
And it's this divine healing stream, and I was able to experience that in my body.
Could you describe that feeling? I've read about it, but I'd like to hear how you would describe it.
For me, what I experienced, it's a very gentle but powerful vibration in my body. Sometimes it can feel like tingling.
Or throughout your body or in the problem area?
Throughout the body. Mm-hmm. However, the healing stream is highly intelligent. It will go to the place in the body that needs healing. So in my case, with that back pain, the pain in my back would actually intensify when I was at the community hours, and gradually that became better. But Bruno Gröning would call that the regulation pain, which sometimes the pain that is experienced the Heilstrom is experienced as pain in the problem areas as it is being healed.
I see. So since this experience, how has the pain in your back been?
The pain in my back is essentially healed. Sometimes I feel it a little bit. But really, another important thing that I want to say is that Bruno said that the physical healings are only 5% of the teaching. Mm-hmm. And the other 95% is this, the impact that this connection to God has on one's life in all aspects. So I would say just the overall experience of peace and joy and well-being that I have felt getting stronger in myself and my life in these years that I've been in the circle of friends is one of the most important things that I would want to share with people.
And when you meet with the circle of friends, what do the meetings consist of?
We gather to take in this healing stream together. We meet for about an hour and a half every 3 weeks. And it consists of hearing about the life of Bruno, healing. We hear healing reports. There's this medical scientific group that records all of the healings that continue, and we hear reports of that. People share their own experiences, and then the main thing is that we take in this healing energy together.
And how do you do that? How do you prepare yourselves to receive that energy?
Well, it's really very simple, and that's one of the main things about coming to the lecture, the medical lecture. There are going to be several of those in Ames and Des Moines.
Right.
But essentially, the essential part of the teaching is that we separate ourselves from all thoughts of the illness. We give that all away, and we sit in a very relaxed and comfortable position, and we ask to be connected to the Heilstrom. Very simple. It feels very natural and easy. Yeah, anybody can do it.
So I've watched several videos that are on the internet from the Circle of Friends and about the life of Bruno Gröning. And the position that they recommend you sit in, I would call that a meditative position. You know, on a chair, but not sitting cross-legged on the floor, but on the chair with your hands on your thighs with the palms turned up. And a lot of the videos have a lot of images of nature, just relaxing and relaxing music. Would you describe this as a meditative state that you get into?
I think so, yeah. It has the qualities of calm and stillness and peace and joy. So, yeah, I think that it does feel like that to me. I would say that for myself, I have tried a lot of different kinds of meditation, and this particular connection feels the most visceral and direct to me.
Okay. You mentioned the medical and scientific circle. Could you say a bit more about that?
This is a group of physicians who are all within the Circle of Friends. And the medical scientific group was founded in 1992 to medically verify the healings. And they're very particular about this data to really keep the integrity of the Circle of Friends. And there are many, many thousands of medically verified reports of healing through this medical scientific group.
Now, as I mentioned, I've watched quite a few of these videos, and there does seem to be a difference between the videos that concentrate more on the life of Bruno Gröning and talk to some of the old people who are still alive or were still alive when the videos were made, who were healed by him, I suppose they'd say, or in one case, the daughter of someone who had her mother spoke to Bruno Gröning, and Gröning said to her, "Go home, your daughter is healed." It was a skin irritation, itching all over her body, and she was, and the daughter herself experiences. She was talking about this. So that's one kind of video, concentrating more on the life of Bruno Gröning himself, and then the more recent videos, or at least geared more towards present-day audiences, which I've already described a bit, you know, lots of images of nature and telling people how to get into a meditative state. And my question about this is, would you say that there's been a change of emphasis at all from the time that Bruno Gröning was actually very active in the 40s and 50s and today?
I'd say maybe a little bit, although Bruno Gröning, I would describe him as a transmitter of this divine healing stream.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, it has not changed. so that he said that once his body had died, the healings would continue, and whenever anybody called on him, that he would be there to help.
Mm-hmm.
So in some regards, it is similar that he continues to be very much the central figure in the circle of friends. And when we talk about his life, the Heilstrom comes through these facts of his life and the healings.
Yeah, well, he certainly attracted huge crowds. It looks like Jesus preaching to the multitudes when you look at the old photographs.
Yeah, he did, actually. And that really did become problematic for him. A lot of authorities at the time became threatened by what he was able to do. And ultimately, he was prohibited from healing.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Yeah, in one case, there were 30,000 people who gathered to have contact with him.
Huge crowds concern people at the best of times, and they accused him of all sorts of things, practicing medicine without a license and so on. But talking about controversial things, I'd like to hear what you have to say about Bruno Gröning's death. He did die at a relatively young age of cancer.
Yeah, he died in 1959, and after he was prohibited from healing, he became very sick. And it was really clear that Bruno Gröning, his entire life was about helping and healing. And when he was not allowed to heal, he became very ill. And he became more and more ill, and it was kind of like he was burned up from the inside out.
Yeah, that's how he described it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really very fascinating.
That was Sonia Anderson talking to me from Minnesota about her experience as a member of the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends. There will be a lecture by representatives of the Circle of Friends tomorrow, May the 17th, at Ames Public Library at 6 p.m. I'm your host, Kay Patuck, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Our topic today is mind-body medicine, and I'd like to point out that the meditative state that Sonia Anderson just described is what Dr. Herbert Benson of Harvard Medical School would call the relaxation response, which is also the title of one of his books. The second element operating in this kind of healing, the element of strong belief, Dr. Benson calls a faith factor. He points out that medical researchers are completely familiar with the power of the faith factor, although they call it the placebo effect, and they work hard to try to minimize its effect in drug trials. But as Dr. Benson points out, the placebo effect is one of the most powerful therapeutic forces available to humankind. And he stresses that instead of trying to minimize its effects, it would be better if we worked harder to study those effects and to enhance them. So let's hear more about that enhanced placebo effect, or faith factor, from Susan Kalin, who spoke with me by telephone from Wisconsin. Welcome, Susan.
Oh, thank you. Welcome.
And I'd like you to start just by telling us why you yourself are a member of the Circle of Friends.
Sure. Yeah, I came to the Circle of Friends looking for help, especially for my body. And I found that I received something there that I couldn't get anywhere else. I had had, among other things, a frozen shoulder. Couldn't raise. Actually, both shoulders were like that, but especially my left one.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone to an acupuncturist and taken herbs and tried all kinds of things, spent a lot of money, and I came to this meeting, and suddenly I felt a lot of sensations during the meeting.
Could you describe those sensations?
Yeah, actually, I felt as though the pain got worse in the meetings, but I was told that that could happen, and so I just found it. I just had a sense something was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then I followed the teachings as they were told to us. And after a few meetings, I don't remember exactly when, I just realized one day it had completely vanished, and it no longer woke me up at night when I'd, you know, turn over in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just one of the first things that happened. But I really realized that there was this force available that seemed to work in so many ways. And I just wanted to keep coming. And, you know, one thing I can say, too, is I was so used to spending money to try to get help in so many different ways, and also emotionally, psychologically, just spiritually. And all of this was completely free and seemed to have a universal benefit that seemed to go in all different kinds of directions for my body and for my life. So, you know, the more I went, the more I received, and I just kept wanting to go and be more and more involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the frozen shoulders were cured, what other benefits did you perceive you were getting from the Circle of Friends?
Yeah, I had to take care of my mother, who was in her late 90s, and this had been so stressful. So many things I didn't, you know, we don't have control over. I was constantly researching and trying to figure out ways to help her with symptoms. I tend to like holistic things, so. And this caused me a lot of stress and sleeplessness. And one of the benefits was that I realized that I could also use this to help her. And so somehow many things she was suffering with also got better when I did this for her, even though she herself didn't really believe in it. And it also really calmed me down and just made everything simpler.
Now, you said you did this for her. What did that entail exactly?
So the way that this was able to help my mother was that I opened up to this energy as I was taught and followed the simple teachings that are taught and basically asked for my mother on her behalf. And, you know, she could feel it. She could sense that she was feeling better, and sometimes there would be a crisis, and I would do this. This, it's called Einstellen, which means to connect to the energy, and I would find that she would feel better, her blood pressure would go down, and many other symptoms seemed to go away or get better for her. And even though she herself didn't believe it, she didn't believe in anything, let's say anything spiritual, because she had a sort of a negative experiences in her life with the Catholic Church. But she knew something was happening. She sensed that when I would tend to her, she could feel something good.
Now, I'm still not absolutely clear. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of... like, so you would go to the meeting of the Circle of Friends, you'd be in the group there, and you would think of your mother? Or was this, in other words, was this sort of distant healing, or did you do something when you were actually with your mother? I'm not quite sure how this worked.
Yeah, so I would go to the meetings, and we collectively, together, take in this healing power.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about someone that, you know, especially someone we love and care about, then we can ask for them on their behalf. And
so the whole group, as it were, would ask. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we can do it both ways. Sometimes just silently by ourselves.
Okay.
But, you know, the power of many people coming together in a community seemed to really amplify the effects and the benefits. And so that would be one thing. But I would also be able to do it at home by myself, simply sitting in a room by myself and asking for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
But also applying the teachings, which has to do with the way we think about illness and health. And that is also necessary for this to be really effective. And that's something that I learned by coming on an ongoing basis to the community hours.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the healing aspect of the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends is just one aspect of it. That there is there's a worldview that goes with it.
Yeah, you know, Bruno Gröning said that what happens here, the healings are only 5% of what happens. But it's really about connecting to a divine force and believing in the good, believing that health is the truth and peace is the truth, and that we should believe in it and not pay attention to illness and to bad things, to negative things, and that this is what our focus should be with our minds, with our thoughts.
And I understand this is completely non-denominational, this group.
Yes.
Now, you live in Wisconsin, right? And so how would you describe the sort of the makeup of the group, your group there in Wisconsin?
Well,
I mean, their religious background, their ethnic background.
Yeah,
Just the demographics, the ages, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Our particular group in Madison happens to be more, I'd say, ranging in 40s and 50s. It just happens to be the age at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are communities around the world where there are youth communities and children. So that just happens to be ours. And we have probably, I would say, Buddhist and Christian and what would you call it? I don't know what to call it, pagan or...
pagan, yeah.
You know, a variety uh-huh. of backgrounds, yeah.
Yeah, and that is a heritage from Bruno Gröning himself, I believe. He was non-denominational.
Bruno Gröning had said that, he said, I never ask a person their nation or their religion. Human being is human being. There is no difference.
Do you think part of this philosophy came from his experiences in the Second World War?
Well, I think that he was born with something special, where he mm-hmm. understood the nature, the true nature of life. Because he was like this even as a child. He already understood that people had taken the wrong path and that he was there to help them. And so often, even in his presence, people would feel better. And so they would often ask him, they would say, please bring little Bruno over. He makes us feel so good when he's around.
I don't wish to denigrate him, but presume, do we only have his word for this?
No, this actually, there are many eyewitnesses from his time.
From the time when he was a child.
And a lot of information was gathered because, you know, there were books written about him. There was films made about him. And so...
Yeah, he did have a huge following. Yes, I know
and
that.
Yeah. He came to have a huge following.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay. Is there anything I've left out that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
Well, I would say that... I could say so much. I could talk a little bit about the Circle of Friends itself. Maybe you've already asked.
Go ahead. I don't necessarily... I did, but go ahead.
So the Circle of Friends has communities in 120 countries on every continent, and people of every color and nationality and religion are involved. And Bruno Gröning never wanted anyone to leave their religion. He said, stay in your religion, but really believe. And he basically acted as, and acts now, as a little transformer. He said, that's all I am, is a little transformer that connects people back to this divine power that we collectively had strayed from. we had strayed from nature. And he said, this is all about, really, this is about the forces of nature. And people became enamored with trying to do things themselves and leave nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so-called civilization. But all of this, he said, was bad for the earth and bad for people's health. And now he was calling us back to this natural path. But he needed, people needed help because they were so distant that they literally needed some sort of a spiritual connection. And so this is how he, this is what he does. And that's why people, when they connect, they often feel sensations in their bodies because there's literally a force that he connects us to. And we can actually feel it when we open to it.
Okay. Well, this is most interesting.
And I would say, what I would add about Bruno Gröning was that as a person, as a human being, he was, there were so many people, you know, eyewitnesses at the time who talked about how kind he was, that he had very little money. He worked. He was a simple working man.
Right.
But even with his own money, he would give away his last penny to people and never took a cent for the healings. He said that these healings came from God and you can't pay God because God already owns everything.
Mm-hmm.
And but his nature, his really deeply human nature is something that touches me, his human kindness and his willingness to help people out in every way when he was alive.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Susan. And I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in this, and hopefully they'll be encouraged to come to the lectures or the meetings or whatever. What do you like to call them? Do you like to call them lectures? Or
I would say, yeah, like it's just like an informative lecture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And the best of luck with your lecture series.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us on your show. Thank
well,
you.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The first of the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends lectures in Ames will be tomorrow, May 17th, at Ames Public Library at 6 p.m. Then on Friday, May the 20th, there'll be another lecture at the Ames Friends Meeting House at 7. I'm your host, Kay Patuk, and this is Local Talk. Our topic today is mind-body medicine, and we've just heard a bit about the healer Bruno Gröning's life. My next guest, Professor Jeremy Best of Iowa State University, is an expert on German history. I talked with him about the historical and religious background from which Bruno Gröning and his movement emerged. I really appreciate your coming in today to talk to us, especially as you're going to Europe on a trip soon. It's very nice of you to fit us in here.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Well, we're here to talk about this remarkable mass movement led by Bruno Gröning. I didn't pronounce that correctly, I'm sure, but we'll hear you pronounce it soon correctly, which emerged in Germany in about 1949. You're a historian with a special expertise on German religious networks and German missionary activity before the First World War. And I wonder what light you can cast on the religious and intellectual background out of which a remarkable phenomenon like Bruno Gröning emerged in Germany at this time, just after the Second World War.
Yeah, so this period after the Second World War in Germany is a period of particular dislocation. And Bruno Gröning's background as a Ostdeutscher, as an Easterner, he was from the city of Danzig. And Danzig, after the First World War, had been made an international city, the main port for the Polish Republic that was founded. But after the Second World War, the Soviets and the Red Army moved the border of Poland westward about 100 miles or so. And that created a very large group of Ostdeutsche, or Eastern Germans, who were refugees.
Right.
And many of these people actually settled in places where labor was in high demand after the war. And many of them ended up where he ended up, in the western area, the Rhineland region of the country, where there was the heavy industrialization. And so in those areas, there was a particular density of Eastern refugees who were resettled. It took a long time. Actually, by 1949, they would not have been fully settled. You had a lot of a very strong housing crisis still in West Germany. And these folks would have brought with them, on top of the dislocation from the Second World War, they would have brought with them a man like Gröning would have brought with him a certain sense of loss and
right.
a certain and I would say that the context there, regardless of not knowing how Gröning felt specifically in that moment, I would say it's very likely that in that space, in that time, there was certainly a sense of dislocation, a certain sense of seeking new community and seeking new answers. Yeah, I mean, that'd be a good place to start with that.
The fact that Germany had lost the Second World War, and of course, Bruno Gröning's whole life was disrupted by these two world wars. His childhood by the First World War, and then he had a pretty awful experience in the Second World War, too.
The First World War, he would have been in his late childhood, early teens through the war, would have experienced on the home front, which was a very deep privation during that period. The death rates for children and for women went up during the First World War. And in fact, after the war ended, the British continued the blockade. And then it goes into the crises of the new Weimar Republic. And so his whole life would have been through the First World War, when he was just coming into awareness, I would say, at 8 years old, and then through the First World War, the interwar period with all of its well-known dislocations around the destruction of the German Empire, the creation of the Weimar Republic, hyperinflation during the 1920s, and then the Great Depression, and then the rise of the Nazis right into the Second World War. I mean, this is a man who I would say his lifetime would have really captured quite richly the chaos, I guess, of German life in this period. And not as a psychologist, but I would think that anyone who grew up through these periods and came of age and sought work and sought all these sort of formative experiences in a period of profound instability would have been open to many new ideas.
So. And his message would have had particular appeal at this time, I presume. He was basically a pacifist, apparently.
Yeah.
He was drafted at the Second World War, but he got into serious trouble because he made it clear not willing to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
He was basically a blue-collar worker all his life.
To sort of get a sense of how he might have felt during the Nazi period, blue-collar folks, there were working-class people who definitely supported the Nazis, but there's a fair amount of scholarship and historians who've argued that because of how deeply social democratic and communist the German working class was, by the late 1930s, there's a fair amount of evidence that they were starting to push back against the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have made him even more alienated from the Nazi period. But at the same time, there's also, of course, plenty of evidence of people who perhaps experienced the Nazi period, embraced it or were more willing to participate, but who were also turned off after the war and who also turned to pacifism.
Now, his influence was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in 1949, in the city of Rosenheim,
mm-hmm.
crowds estimated to be at about 30,000 people would come to hear him every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to get at, you know, what was the basis of his appeal at this time for these huge crowds?
Well, there's...
I mean, it looks like, you know, except the dress is wrong, it looks like Jesus preaching to the multitudes or something.
Sure, and so there's sort of two parallel answers that I think we can see here. One is to build off of what I said about this dislocation in Germany after the war. There's a sense, the way in which most Germans seemed interested in dealing with the past, with the Nazi era, was through a clean break and an idea of that was the past and some terrible things happened. But now we have to get to the business of rebuilding and moving on, of building an economically viable state to a slightly lesser degree, but also still a committed degree, building some form of democracy. And so in that situation of people willing to put the past behind them, I would say that someone like Gröning, who offered who was preaching a new message and a new way of being and a new way of healing. I think the other part is his emphasis on healing, both within the spiritual healing, but of course it's not hard to then, if you're a listener, to convert that into a more national or community healing. And this idea that Germany needed to heal itself, and I don't know that he ever preached something that specifically, but a general sense of moving on. Within his message, this idea of going back to the wisdom of the past and of the ancients actually connects both to an idea of looking further back, you know, going... 12 years, the last 12 years, we need to go past that. And, you know, in fact, the Weimar Republic was pretty bad too, so we need to go past another 10 years back. And really, the Kaiserreich wasn't so great either, the German Empire of Wilhelm II wasn't so great. And so you see this sort of searching for a past that's usable. That also, though, so that's one area. It also, that, and what I think is very interesting is that this, he comes into a moment at the same time that Scientology comes into its moment.
I didn't realize that.
It's in the 40s and 50s, this moment. And while there are a couple parallels here that I think are interesting to think about, one is that L. Ron Hubbard was also somewhat traumatized by his war experiences and came to lead a new religion. A similar parallel is that Scientology and Gröning's movement are treated in very similar ways by the German government, as far as I can understand the law without getting too deeply into that. And that Scientology and Gröning's movement are treated somewhat similarly by the German government through the various legal definitions of religious rights and privileges is an interesting parallel as well. But beyond that, within Scientology's message about alternative knowledge bases and alternative sources of power and knowledge and this interest in self-examination, I think that there are parallels to Gröning's discussing this wisdom of the ancients and this alternative mysticism that's very interesting. And, of course, there are other movements, and there's a certain, to use the German word, there's a certain zeitgeist of the time,
right,
transnationally about seeking out alternative spiritual paths that are often clearly drawing from existing traditions. They're never really sui generis.
That was Professor Jeremy Best of the History Department at Iowa State, drawing our attention to the historical realities of Bruno Gröning's time that would have caused a person like him to seek transformative experiences for himself and his audiences. Professor Best also raises the possibility that part of the appeal of Gröning's message would have been an appeal to national and community healing, the idea that Germany needed to heal itself to find a completely new direction. And as far as I can find out from various online sources, that certainly was part of Gröning's message. He often said that he was calling for all humanity to experience a great reversal. Here's a translation of a few of his words on this subject. "The sole purpose of my deeds and workings is to guide all people on this earth once again onto the right path, onto the divine path. This is the great reversal." But now I'd like to introduce my final guest today. She's someone who could be described as having a professional expertise on spiritual healing. She's the Reverend Deb Hill Davis, the minister at Unity Church on 9th Street here in Ames. I ask Reverend Deb to begin by telling us about the philosophy of Unity Church and the Unity Movement. And on this segment of our conversation, she's talking about how Unity began at the end of the 19th century, growing out of the personal experiences of a married couple, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore.
They began out of Myrtle Fillmore's experience of attending a lecture in the Chicago area by a man named E.B. Weeks. She came away with the affirmation, "I am a child of God. Sickness is not my inheritance." And she had been ill with tuberculosis most of her adult life and, in fact, had been told there was nothing that the medical doctors could do for her. This was in 1886. And she began working with that affirmation, "I'm a child of God, sickness is not my inheritance." And she used that as a prayer and as a repeated affirmation. Over 2 years of doing that, she was finally free of tuberculosis. So it was a process of affirming her health and changing at depth her concept of who she was. As a child of God, she did not inherit sickness.
And this is around the time of Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science.
Yes. They were all contemporaries, and they shared a common teacher in Emma Curtis Hopkins. And what they were exploring, it was called New Thought because they were exploring the power of your mind to impact your physical body. and then the power of your mind connected to spirit and to God. So something greater than yourself. So the exploration was really the relationship between body, mind, and spirit, which was a relatively new thing to be exploring at that time of human evolution and consciousness.
Just one thing I'd like to make clear for our listeners and for myself. What is your attitude to ordinary conventional medicine?
We are very accepting of that.
So this is something extra.
Well, it's something I would say in partnership. So using conventional medicines is perfectly acceptable within unity, but to do it in partnership with prayer and spiritual practices as well. So the two, one doesn't replace the other. The two are partners because at the bottom of it, I guess I believe all healing is ultimately spiritual healing because our mind and our spirit, that which is greater than we are, is involved in our human life. And so we are both spirit and we are human. And so the interaction of the energy of that is what we're hoping and wanting to work with in this spiritual healing piece. So that's the journey.
And what actually happens during services at Unity, Reverend Deb?
Well, there's usually a message and there's singing and there is a time of meditation, yes. And then we have a regular meditation service once a week, and that's on Wednesday nights. And that's a half hour of just sitting in silence in the meditation practice.
And so, you sit on chairs or?
Oh, we sit in the pews, yeah. But Unity is very compatible with all the other traditions that do have a meditation component, like Buddhism and all of the other. It's becoming a popular thing
it
to
is.
Meditate
it
these
is.
Days.
Well, yes, everyone knows it's like good for your blood pressure and stuff
Right, and your mental state.
Right.
It really is very, very helpful. And the quiet, our culture is so noisy. And so to have a time that is just quiet is very, very valuable.
Yes, and to learn to be comfortable with that too.
Yes, yes.
Later in our conversation, the Reverend Deb and I talked about the flip side, the negative side, that the power of our minds and our beliefs can sometimes have on our health. As we discuss in this next segment, the negative side can be especially problematic as it relates to end-of-life issues.
We were talking a little bit before, and I mentioned Dr. Herbert Benson of the Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And he does talk about something called the faith factor. In other words, just what you were saying, really, the importance of believing in something bigger than yourself. He talks about the importance of meditative techniques, which he calls the relaxation response. And then in the subsequent book, he talks about beyond the relaxation response, and that thing beyond is the faith factor. He calls the faith factor, as far as I understand it, he describes it as an enhanced placebo response. Now, we're all sort of familiar with that, you know, in drug trials and so on. If people think they're getting a beneficial drug, even if they're getting something inert, you know, in the control experiment, they quite often get better. But the flip side of that is if they think they're being given, for example, chemotherapy, and in fact they're a control and they're getting something inert, although they're not getting anything that would make their hair fall out, their hair might fall out. And that is what I believe is called the nocebo effect. And so that would be just the flip side of what you were talking about.
And in fact, that's probably what Myrtle was experiencing, in that she had accepted the idea that she was from a family and that her genetic line was sickly. And therefore, that's what she experienced, because she believed that that was true about her. And what both of those demonstrate is the power of our mind and the power of our mind connected to something bigger than we are, because what we have to step out of is what our own limited perceptions of ourselves. You have to step beyond that and see that there is something bigger And in healing of all kinds, that is definitely, I think, a part of the picture.
Now, this is more a question. Well, I think maybe it is more a question for a minister than for a doctor, because it's to do with feelings and so on more than sort of physical medicine. Let's suppose, now this is something, for example, that happened to my brother-in-law. He had very bad form of cancer. It involved his pancreas and his gallbladder, as I understand. Anyway, he was told he had, I think they said 4 months to live. In fact, he lived 4 more years, mm-hmm. and a lot of that was very good years. Now, he did work very hard at getting to stay with his family a bit longer, and he used every possible therapy, all the conventional ones. He did a load of research in an almost militaristic way he researched, but he also utilized whatever he could find out about various spiritual therapies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question to you is, given that what you were talking about, the power of the mind and so on, the power of negative thinking, when a person is given this sort of shattering news that their loved one or themselves has got a certain amount of time to live, what is the right mental attitude to adopt to that? You don't want to be blind and bury your head in the sand. On the other hand, you want to think as positively as you can, but you want to be realistic. So in a spiritually enlightened way, how would you?
Your brother-in-law clearly didn't accept that time limit. And I think we all have that internal voice about what time limit we want to accept. As a minister, I've been with people who are very near death, but do not pass mm-hmm. until someone they need to reconcile with arrives.
Right. Oh, sure.
And
yes.
So, you know, the power of the human spirit in alignment with that energy of all that is actually quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these days, the doctors are less inclined to give people a time limit.
Well, a very definite one, yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, like in my parents' generation, when they were young, people used to lie, doctors used to lie mm-hmm. and not let people know that they had what was apparently an incurable disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people would agree that that's not good either. You should be honest with people.
Right.
But on the other hand, you don't want to blight or voodoo them.
Yes, exactly. And so it's this dance that, mm-hmm. that you do with, I mean, we all have a deadline.
Yeah, no one gets through life alive.
Exactly. So what is it we're going to do with the time we have, and what is it that we want to know, that we want to learn, what do we want to experience? Those are all, you know, the questions of things that really matter. And I think the questions of ultimate meaning. And, you know, when you grapple with that and you have a determination and you explore, you know, the things that might be the obstacles to your healing, that's a journey in itself. And when we hold grudges and we hold anger and we hold a lot of negative emotions inside, that can be very toxic
sure.
to our physical well-being, you know, mm-hmm. the tensions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So learning to be present to what is without, it's like being in this world without being of the world. So being present to what is happening in your life without it driving you. You are encountering whatever comes your way, but it isn't going to take over who you really are. Because what and who you are is bigger than that. And I wouldn't say it's unrealistic. It is more grounded in that greater reality and a knowing that when you need to have those crucial conversations with your loved ones, you know, prayer and meditation is a process that helps you discern that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that ability and power, spiritual power of discernment of the story is told of Myrtle Fillmore right about a week before she made her transition, before she died. She was at Unity Village and she went to every office and every person who worked there to tell them how much she appreciated their work and mm-hmm. their commitment and their love for her. and that she loved them. And after she had finished all of that, then within a week, she made her transition.
She died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, she'd finished her work on this.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you are connected to all of that within yourself, I think we have an inner knowing and an inner listening that says, now is the time.
That was the Reverend Deb Hill Davis of Unity Church here in Ames, talking about spiritual healing and the way it relates to end-of-life issues. I'm your host, Kay Puttock, and on this edition of Local Talk on KHY Community Radio, we've been focusing on mind-body medicine, also known as spiritual healing. Earlier in the program, I spoke with Sonia Anderson and Susan Kylin, members of the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends, and with Jeremy Best, professor of history at Iowa State University. If you're interested in the topic of mind-body medicine, be sure to watch out for the upcoming program of Local Talk, when I'll be talking with Dr. Herbert Benson, professor at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Benson Henry Institute of Mind-Body Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. And if you'd like to know more about the Bruno Gröning Circle of Friends, there's the first of a series of lectures tomorrow, May the 17th, at Ames Public Library at 6 p.m., where you can hear about the group from an international team of medical and spiritual practitioners. We'll post more information on our website. This has been Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. Our theme music is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, hoifm.org. Or just drop by the studio at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames, where you're always welcome. If you've enjoyed this show, please tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You'll find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron. And KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI's other shows. And now stay tuned for Morning Masterpieces. And please remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.